With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there and welcome to the Stock Club podcast, coming to you from the top floor of my Wall Street HQ here in Dublin, Ireland. I'm James, and with me this week is my Wall Street co-founder and chief investor, Emmett Savage, and our head analyst, Rory Caron. Today, we're talking about SoftBank's $6.5 billion loss, the most profitable company in the world going public, and two mega trends that we're keeping our eye on over the next 10 years. Okay, guys, so let's kick off today and talk about SoftBank. So last week, SoftBank reported their quarterly earnings, and for the first time in 14 years, they reported a quarterly loss of $6.5 billion. A lot of this came from their $100 billion Vision Fund. That specifically had an operating loss of $8.9 billion during the quarter, and it was driven mainly by the troubles of Uber and, most significantly, WeWork. Rory, are you surprised?
No, not at all. I mean, I think what was most surprising was the presentation was put out last week, and I stumbled upon it through Twitter.
Yeah.
And clicked into the link and started going through the presentation. And it's very odd. Like, as someone who goes through investor presentations all the time, this didn't seem right. There was something weird about it.
Yeah.
And it had a kind of strange, kind of stormy sea narrative at the start, and we work bad kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then it just descended into kind of real. Remember when we talked about the WeWork S1?
Yeah. What was the famous, the line?
The opening line, which is like, we're here to elevate the world's consciousness.
Yeah, that was
Yeah. So like, I
how
said,
could I forget that?
Well, when I read that, I said that was the most bizarre thing I'd ever seen from an investing point of view. This kind of was, I could kind of see where it was coming from when I saw this presentation by SoftBank. There was just these kind of graphs where like, money goes in and profit goes up, and there's no like figures attached to it whatsoever. There's no time period attached to it. It's an XY graph with no legend whatsoever. Yeah. There was one slide which said gross profit down, operating expenses up equals negative EBITDA, and then the next slide said gross profit up, operating expenses down, EBITDA positive.
Yeah,
and literally it was this was like the plan to turn WeWork around.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is crazy. How are you, like, you can't be a $100 billion company and present this kind of stuff to shareholders.
Yeah.
But they did. So following up from that presentation, I went back and looked through a couple of other SoftBank presentations. And trust me, they only get weirder. There's one particular from 2010, which was like Masson's 30-year vision.
Yeah.
For the business.
And this is when he was launching the Vision Fund, was it?
It was a bit before that.
Okay.
It was just his kind of 30-year vision for the whole business. Maybe we'll get on and talk about that a little later, and maybe talk about in specifically this kind of Vision Fund thing that SoftBank have going on at the moment. There's a great piece in the New York Times today, which basically focused on the kind of companies that they've been investing in. It's a $100 billion fund, the largest venture capital fund ever created, like 10 times bigger than most venture capital funds. They've invested in a huge variety of businesses, but there is a real reoccurring theme with the kind of companies they're going after. Mm. And it's those companies that kind of focus on turning people into commodities. And I know that sounds kind of harsh.
Yeah.
But it's this gig economy, contractor-led focus on everything. And it's nearly all paid for by these incentives that SoftBank is pushing into the companies. I'll just give you a couple of examples of companies that SoftBank has backed. So huge amount of ride-hailing services we've talked about already. Grab in Southeast Asia, Didi in China, Uber obviously in the US. There's one called Ola in India. There's a couple in South America. They've got a lot of food delivery businesses, which we've talked about before. They've got a couple of real estate companies, a few logistics businesses, and a hotel business in India as well. And nearly all these companies have this same thing where they are basically taking someone, removing them from employment as a category and paying them on demand.
Yeah.
And the way they're attracting people is with these huge cash incentives, which in the last year or two have been really drying up as SoftBank suddenly goes, we have to stop losing lots and lots of money. And all these people are being like really wrung out to dry. You know, you think about people who work for, there's, you know, the piece talks about a South American food delivery business where the person, so the only thing that the person has to buy is the bike, the jacket and the bag for this delivery service, which comes to $25, which to us doesn't seem like a lot. But in Colombia, that's a huge amount of money for someone.
Yeah.
And they're getting, they were promised to be paid kind of like way more. They were promised to be paid like $1 per delivery.
Yeah.
Which would mean they were making way more than the average annual or the average daily wage.
Okay.
But suddenly now they're being paid 45 cents
yeah.
per delivery because SoftBank suddenly is stopping funding.
Pulling back on these incentives.
They're pulling back on these incentives. And so people are now having to work 7 days a week just to keep themselves going. This is a real kind of theme that's going through these SoftBank investments, which is this growth at no cost, growth without ever thinking when the profit's ever going to drop to the bottom line. And I think what it's actually doing, it's creating these kind of soft, flabby businesses that, for one, have never actually had to make a profit. So they've never had to prove themselves.
Yeah.
And two, have very rarely ever faced direct competition. So like, you know, SoftBank pulled Uber out of China because it didn't want it interfering with Didi. It pulled Uber out of Southeast Asia because it didn't want it interfering with Grab. And, you know, Nassim Taleb has a phrase, anti-fragile,
yeah.
which is something that rather than being just robust, rather than being, you know, resilient, actually gets stronger the more you attack it.
Yeah.
And companies are supposed to be anti-fragile. More competition is supposed to strengthen a company and make it better and make it more profitable, you know, if they survive the challenge.
Yeah.
Whereas now you have these companies that have never really been tested in a competitive environment and the valuations just are high in the sky. There's no idea what they're valued at. Because
Uber's very clearly the perfect example of that, because in the North American market, Lyft is there and it's a race to zero really in terms of incentives and for drivers and users.
Yeah, well, we're not, like, we still haven't, Uber hasn't shown yet that it has a path to profitability. It's, you know, tried Uber Eats, which we've been talking about in here. Food delivery doesn't seem like it's a profitable business either. And now, so they're trying new things. They're trying Uber Freight. You know, they're trying helicopters, they're trying scooters. They're basically
yeah.
just creating new companies every couple of months to try and figure something that's going to work.
Yeah.
And we don't know if it will or not. You know, yeah. we just don't know. That's why I think the market has reacted to Uber the way it has.
Absolutely. So then back to SoftBank itself and that $6.5 billion loss. The Vision Fund has always been, you know, when you mentioned SoftBank over the past few years, it's about the Vision Fund. And how badly do you think confidence in the Vision Fund 2 will be affected by this loss?
So one of the slides on that original presentation, and this is kind of one that's quite interesting, because there's a slide which shows the current market cap of SoftBank, which I think is around $80 billion.
Yeah.
And then there's the total value of SoftBank with all its interests is somewhere around $210 billion. And this is kind of a slide MassiveSun is showing to investors being like, look how undervalued our company is. And that's kind of like, it's, you know, we talk about SoftBank and how the companies, or the Vision Fund, sorry, and how some of the companies in that are grossly overvalued. But that's still a very small part of everything.
Yeah.
You know, they've got Alibaba, a huge stake in Alibaba. They've got Yahoo Japan. They've got Sprint. These companies we kind of can assess a value to. And the value of it is actually around the $200 billion mark. So what does it say when the market is valuing your company $120 billion less than it should? It clearly signifies they have very little confidence in you.
Yeah.
So he was showing this as a positive.
Yeah.
If I was an investor looking at that, I'd be like, what do you mean? You can't convince the market to value our company
yeah.
anywhere near what it's supposed to be valued at.
$120 billion off.
Because they clearly think he's going to take the money he's making from these good investments and throw them into bad investments.
Yeah.
So very little confidence in that guy at the moment. Which brings us back to this.
So we probably need to give a little bit of context here. So in Rory's research, he sent this to me on Slack last Friday, I think it was. And in his research on SoftBank for this piece, he found a deck, I suppose, a slide deck from SoftBank. It's actually dated June 25th, 2010. And it's titled SoftBank Next 30-Year Vision. And it's a sight to behold.
It, like, if you were interviewing someone for a job, right, and even like an entry-level job,
yeah,
and they showed up with a presentation like this, you would laugh them out of the room. You'd fall on the floor laughing and like thank them for giving you the best laugh of your life and wish them well. Like, it's ridiculous. It's the most insane. It looks like someone who's never used PowerPoint before put it together.
It is the craziest PowerPoint presentation I have ever seen in my life. Yeah. Nothing compares to it. If you were to recruit someone who's deluded and anti-creational, they couldn't come up with something
like
better.
Yeah, if you ever worry that a big presentation you're giving isn't up to scratch, go to this, click on this link, right? And you will be so relieved that $100 billion company gets away with this sort of stuff.
Quickly, what's your favorite slide from it, if you had to pick one?
There's so many good ones. I mean, there's one where he's talking about the future with telepathy, and there's like a lot of really bad stock images of people, and then there's like a little Wi-Fi signal coming out of one of their heads.
Yeah, they're all holding their temples.
And then there's two dogs with Wi-Fi symbols coming out of their heads. Like, we're going to communicate telepathically with dogs. That's probably my favorite, but there's so many to choose from.
Yeah. Like,
the world in 300 years ago. There was the world in 300 years ago, which makes you pause and go, what's being said here? And then it goes through the evolution, industrial revolution, steam engine, iron making technology, and basically concludes with a picture of riots by people who feared machines. Smashing up, I think it was the Luddites, whoever, he doesn't say, but it was the guys who smashed up the looms.
Riots by people who feared machines. There's another one where it's like two people in front of it's the stock images, I think, are the most offensive part. It's just like Googling two people standing in front of an ocean and whatever pops up first, and the caption is, "Yet people long for love and get hurt by love." Hurt him?
And also unsavory topics like a trend line of people who tragically took their own lives in Japan over 5-10 years. You're like, what relevance has this? And it just isn't, it just, nothing makes sense in it.
I shared it with a group of friends in a WhatsApp group, and like none of them are into investing per se. And I kind of said, like, look, I understand reading an investor presentation isn't what you guys had planned for a Friday afternoon, but really, please, please take a look at this. And like some of them started sending like, you know, their favorite slides. And one of the guys wrote back, he's like, I encourage you to view the whole presentation as these excerpts possibly make it seem more sane and less relentlessly threatening than it really is.
So my favorite slide I just happened across here is a graph of the number of brain cells.
Oh,
so a human being has 30 billion brain cells, a chimpanzee is 8 billion, an insect has 1 million, and an amoeba, which we're compared to, has one brain cell. And you're left thinking, why? What relevance? What's the purpose? It's beyond belief.
It's, yeah, I'll include the link in the notes for today's show, but I really, as Rory said, I encourage you to digest this whole presentation.
There's that scene in The Big Short where Steve Carell's character is met with this guy who makes CDOs.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah.
The guy's such like a sleaze bag that after the conversation, Steve Carell walks up to his partners or his buddies and says, short everything that guy touched. That like when you see this and you see that this guy is the guy leading this fund and leading this multi-billion dollar company, you are kind of like, this guy's crazy. Yeah. You need to get far away from everything he's involved in.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, that's right.
Moving on then. Last week, the world's most profitable company, Saudi Aramco, published its prospectus ahead of its long-awaited IPO. For those who don't know, this is the national oil company of Saudi Arabia, and it's expected by some analysts to be valued at as much as $2 trillion after flotation, which would make it the most valuable company by far. Emma, you've been looking at Saudi Aramco over the past few days.
I have indeed, James. It's an interesting one. It's about to, well, they're planning to list on the Riyadh Stock Exchange. Did you live in Riyadh?
No, I lived in Abu Dhabi. Yeah.
Abu Dhabi, are you sure?
Yeah, I forgot there.
So yeah, as Saudi Aramco traces its roots back to 1933, when a deal was struck between Saudi Arabia and the Standard Oil Company of California, which later became Chevron. And they basically came together to survey and drill for oil. And as a result, Saudi Aramco was a new company created to do that. Then a few years later, between 1973 and 1980, Saudi Arabia bought the whole company. So Saudis believed that this was the best place for them to reinvest money from the country. So Saudi Arabia has the second biggest oil reserves in the world after Venezuela.
Yeah.
And is also the second largest producer of oil after the US, would you believe? But it gets its prominence because it has monopoly on all oil in the country. and because of how cheap it is to extract. So that's the big picture. So despite Saudi Arabia spending about 7 or so years buying the whole outfit, Saudi Arabia is now keen to sell its shares or its whole stake in the oil firm because it's trying to reduce its reliance on oil. And the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman wishes to diversify his country's economy in the next decade under a program that he's called the Vision 2030. So that's how the business, if you like, was formed, and the history up to today, and why, in fact, the country is divesting it by floating it in part on the Riyadh Stock Exchange. So let's talk about valuation, because as you said, it's headlined as the world's biggest, most profitable business.
Yeah.
So let's have a closer look at that. What's quite funny is that when I went to download the IPO prospectus, I had to select where I'm from a short list of countries. And when I chose USA, it bumped me out and said, you're not allowed to see this. So I just clicked back and selected other because Ireland wasn't there. And sure enough, I got the IPO prospectus. So I changed my mind. I hacked the system, master hacker that I am. And it is a clanger. This is an IPO to behold, or I should say this is a prospectus to behold. It's 658 pages long.
What?
It's insane. It's actually insane. It's not a million miles from our SoftBank conversation. And you'd need a week to read it and a deciphering expert by your side, because it is a complex tome and they have covered many things. And despite the fact that I couldn't download it under the pretense of being an American in the USA, the very, very, very final page has a state stamp from the state of Texas, and all the engineering reports are signed and sealed by the head of these things in Texas, in the state of Texas. So so that's a prospectus for you, and it was a heavy read, but it did not say how much of the Saudi firm would be sold. Okay. And there's rumours floating out there between 5 and 10% is what's going to go up onto the Riyadh exchange, but that figure has not been crystallised, no more than the date for the listing. So there was wasn't a lot we could deduce about what's happening when. But what was quite interesting was the risks, and the risks associated with investing in the business are quite untypical. And some of the risks included the government's control over oil output, and a very significant risk was listed as a terrorist attack. So in dealing with a 550-odd page prospectus, and in an old world industry in a country that very personally I'm not over familiar with, and risks such as terrorist attack, it's very difficult to define in your mind where this sits. But according to Bloomberg, Saudi Aramco is worth $1.2 trillion, although Riyadh would prefer a valuation of $2 trillion, as you said. You know, who wouldn't, you know, in the intro, which is one of the reasons why the share sales has been delayed several times up until this point. So the most common number out there for the value of the business is $1.5 trillion to $1.7 trillion. And again, if you measure sentiment, that could be a little on the high side.
Yeah.
And I guess for trivial benchmarking's sake, Amazon, as of this moment in time, is worth $881 billion. So these guys are kind of thinking double that. So to just kind of... And it's completely irrelevant. It's comparing an apple to a pumpkin, saying, like, comparing Amazon beside... Saudi Aramco, because really there's no relevance between two businesses. So why is it the possibly going to be the most valuable company in the world? And the answer is, it is phenomenally profitable. I mean, the business is on a different level of profit. So for the first half of this year, Saudi Aramco posted bottom line earnings, or net profit as we say in the sighted world, of $47 billion net profit, which almost all of which was paid out in dividends to the Saudi state. So in the same period, Apple, which we all know very, very well, the world's largest company at the moment by value, posted a net profit, bottom line profit, of $21.6 billion. So just those two numbers beside each other again, Saudi Aramco posted $47 billion and Apple posted nearly $22 billion. So the profit that this business generated in half one of this year was over double that of Apple.
Massive, yeah.
And the only other, I suppose, relative benchmark you might grab onto is that ExxonMobil, the current largest listed oil company, made $5.5 billion in the first half of this year. So this is a very serious money-making machine, and you can see why they are kind of talking about a valuation that exceeds Apple at the moment. So when it floats, I guess the business is going to remain a dividend paying stock. And if the question is, am I excited about the flotation? Am I looking forward to buying shares in the business? The answer is no, not especially, because I can't foresee the largest company in the world that's operating in a very old world industry growing meaningfully from this point on.
Yes, absolutely. And then just in terms of the logistics, if this is listing on the Riyadh Stock Exchange for the common US retail investor, how might those shares be made available?
Difficult if they only float on the Riyadh Exchange. Yeah. Some of the bigger online full service brokerages might offer shares. So like, for example, not a very fair comparison, but there's a specific company on the New Zealand Stock Exchange that I'm very keen to buy shares in, and I logged on to TD Ameritrade, and sure enough, I could get at them.
Okay.
I haven't checked if Riyadh Exchange is, let's say, wired up to TD Ameritrade, but I think it would be quite difficult.
Yeah.
That said, download the prospectus and invest at the sort.
If you have a spare week on your hands.
But there's a really interesting point about how you get a feeling for how truly far this business is from Silicon Valley when you hear them say that local people, even, quote, Saudi female divorcees, will be eligible to buy shares.
Yeah.
You just realise we're talking about a business in a country with a culture that's quite far from the culture that we form in this room and our friends in the US were raised amongst.
Yeah,
no, there's a piece in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, I think, about how it's being advertised heavily and marketed heavily to the Saudi population. This is like their chance to actually own part of what they landed on when they made Saudi Arabia like the country that it is and where it is. Kind of upending years of the status quo, which was that the royal family owned the oil and promised, in order that everyone maintained stability and let them run the place, that they would pay out dividends to the people and keep, you know, socialized medicine and education and jobs and all that kind of stuff. You mentioned Venezuela beforehand. Obviously, you know, Venezuela didn't do this. They thought that they were going to have good times forever on the oil that they had, and when oil prices sank a couple of years ago, you see where that country is now. So it's funny. Saudi Arabia seems to be in a very tough position because on the one hand, they are trying to modernize. They're trying to, they are very into green energy. They're building an entire city that's going to be green energy. What's it called? Xeom or Zome? I can't even pronounce it, but X-E-O-M.
It looked like the Babylon.
Yeah,
when you look at pictures,
incredibly
it's really
futuristic,
amazing.
Ambitious project that's going to be all done on solar energy. But I mean, think about the problems that they have. You know, you mentioned terrorist risks there. There's so many other risks as well. Like, you know, their former biggest customer, the US, is now an exporter of energy, you know, since they've got the shale, and China and the EU leaning heavily towards green energy now.
Yeah.
You know, they're not, this is a shrinking total addressable market.
It is.
Yeah.
And there's a very, the world over is peppered with examples of governments with semi-state or fully state-owned assets that at a peak valuation, they decide will divest this because it's the strategic imperative of the country. Why hold on to an asset that isn't, its future isn't as bright as its past? And I feel very doubtful when I see companies spinning off from state ownership for a whole bunch of reasons.
One of them being experience.
Yes, one of which most people in Ireland experienced, exactly, which was the state telecom operator.
We won't get into that today.
No.
So that was Saudi Aramco. Let's move on to the company we never talk about. Rory, you're going to take it this week and you're going to dive into probably one of the most recognisable and profitable casino operators in the world.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those companies we used to talk about an awful lot, I feel, and then possibly for the wrong reasons, actually. It was about 2 years ago that the founder, CEO, this is Wynn Resorts, by the way, in case anyone hadn't guessed by the casino reference. Steve Wynn it came out that he had been sexually exploiting staff members and had to resign. And since then, a new CEO has come on board, Matt Maddox. And it's funny, if you look at the chart of Wynn Resorts, it kind of has this kind of non-stop roller coaster trajectory where it goes up and then goes down really fast and then goes up and goes down very fast. That obviously, you never use that as a kind of investment thesis because now at the moment it's kind of flattened out again. We start see it going up now. Like Wynn at the moment, so you know, Wynn's operations are split essentially in two, now in three. They've got a Las Vegas operation, which is kind of the steady Eddie, and it's been going on for, you know, 20 years. And then they've got resorts in Macau, which is the peninsula, Chinese-owned peninsula, which is the largest gambling hub in the world by far.
Yeah, so people often think of Las Vegas when they think of gambling, but Macau is many times over.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm gonna paraphrase here, but at one point in the interview, Steve Wynn said, "Macau is the greatest business opportunity that's ever been presented to anyone in the history of the world."
Steady on, Steve.
Yeah,
get, I mean, off the, like, fence.
Well, this was a guy who knew his business, and yeah, you know, Macau is a very, very profitable enterprise.
Yeah.
For the companies that have been allowed to participate. And when I say allowed to participate, what Wynn has that others don't is that it is one of six operators that is allowed to have a casino in Macau. Macau currently is about 80% of the company's operating profits, the other 20% being from Las Vegas. They have two resorts there, one of which is currently covered in construction gear as they rejuvenated, which has caused a little drop in their earnings down there. But that's a real short-term issue that should be finished by next year.
Yeah.
And the reason, I mean, there's a lot of casino operators that are floated, both on the American exchanges and on worldwide exchanges. They're a pretty steady investment for people. The reason we chose Wynn was because Wynn is synonymous with high-end luxury, based largely around what's former CEO Steve Wynn's vision of what a luxury resort should be, which was always grand. He designed the Mirage,
yeah,
the Las Vegas Mirage, and the Bellagio, the famous fountain outside the Bellagio. And he's responsible for some of the most iconic buildings in the world of gambling and the world of Las Vegas and stuff like that. And the reason the reason I think that Wynn is going to be a big winner for us going forward is that Macau is only becoming a bigger story.
Yeah.
There has been a huge amount of infrastructure investment put into Macau. There's a bridge that now connects Hong Kong to Macau. Obviously, Hong Kong is another topic of conversation. There is a new ferry port open, a new light transit system has been building, which should be open next year. They're doing a massive land reclamation project that's going to, I think, increase the land on the island by about 20%, or on the peninsula by about 20%. So this place is growing. China's investing massively into this area, and it's an area that only six companies get to take advantage of.
Yeah.
And Wynn is one of them, and Wynn's one of the best operators in that area. They predict solid Macau visitation and growth over the years. It's become even more than a casino hub. It's going to become a real entertainment hub. It's going to become a place for families to go to for non-gaming entertainment. It's really going to be, you know, the Las Vegas of China, and it's going to be huge.
Okay.
And is very well positioned to be a big, yeah, part of it.
I was invested in one of its competitors, I'd say 10 or 15 years ago, called Melco Crown Resorts, off the very same investing thesis that we're discussing here, which is the peninsula of Macau is the rising mega force in Asian gambling. And it's true. And I think for those very long term investing minds, I think it's phenomenal. I'd love to go and see the place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Company research.
Company way day. Why not?
There's also the fact that, like, there's plenty of more markets opening up over the next 10 years. South Korea is going to be a huge gaming market.
Yeah.
Japan is going to be a huge gaming market. And this is a company that's proven time and time again that it delivers on building high-end luxury resorts that attract people. And it's the reason why they were the only company that got a license for the Boston casino, which,
yeah,
they only opened a couple of months ago, which seems to be doing fine. It's the reason why they got the original gaming license in Macau. They have a reputation that precedes them any time they go in to try and get one of these gaming licenses. And they're just a company I think is going to continue to build on this.
Cool. So that was Wynn Resorts. Don't forget that we've recently launched a desktop version of the My Wall Street app. This means that you can now enjoy our market-beating stock picks and stock of the month selection on any device. Check it out now by going to www.mywallstreet.com and logging in with the same credentials you use in the My Wall Street app. If you're a new user, you can also sign up here to get a 3-day trial of our service completely free. November stock of the month selection is already up close to 10% after reporting on a brilliant quarter recently, and we're adding a new stock to the market beating shortlist on Monday. This is a company, Rory, that was previously kind of targeted by Amazon.
Yeah, heavily targeted by Amazon. And we mentioned earlier Antifragile. This is maybe one of those companies that's Antifragile.
Absolutely. So that's coming to the app on Monday. Make sure to check it out then. Jargon Busters. So we've two questions for Jargon Busters this week. And the first one is actually relates back to our last episode. So since our last episode, Fitbit has been acquired by Google. Rory,
you're going to bring that up.
Rory wasn't too confident it would happen. But
I wasn't confident. I just said it was a rumor. It hadn't been announced yet.
Well, it's on record, Rory. So but, the question, I suppose, now for Fitbit investors is what happens to their shares in Fitbit now that Google has acquired the company?
Well, they haven't actually acquired them yet.
Okay.
So this is me. See, again, I have to correct you each time. they've made the offer to acquire them. It looks like it's a done deal. It'll be finalized at some point, probably next year. They weren't too specific about what quarter or whether it'd be first half or second half. But yeah, they bought them for $2.1 billion. It's $77.35 per share, I think. That represented an 18% premium on the day before its price and a 70% premium on the price just 1 week ago before the rumors started circulating.
Okay.
So Fitbit shareholders getting a good premium on their shares, just in terms of a percentage increase. So what will happen is, well, you've kind of got two options. You can sell your shares at the current price, which is probably about 4 or 5% discount from the actual acquisition price, which that discount is there just in case the deal doesn't go through.
Okay.
So you can sell them now, take the money and reinvest in something else, or you can just wait till it gets finalized, in which case you'll get the full 735 whack, and you will no longer be a Fitbit shareholder.
Yeah.
This is an all cash deal. There's no stock exchange, so you'll just get cash into your account and you can invest it in something else. If you want to invest it in Google, you can.
Yeah.
Keep in mind that Fitbit, it will be literally like 0.1% of the business. so your exposure to Fitbit won't be as great, but just keep in mind that you might have to pay taxes on it as well.
Yeah, force the tax event. Cool. So the second question we have then is about price-to-earnings ratio. So what is a price-to-earnings ratio, Emmett, and how should you use it in assessing a stock?
Sure. Well, P ratio is the current share price, that's the P, divided by the earnings per share or the net profit per share. And it's generally a number ranging from one to multiple of thousands.
Yeah.
Or NA, non-applicable. And the P is a number that has been the focal point of people in our profession for a very, very long time. But I think as the years have gone by and businesses have evolved, it's less relevant. Certainly, I've never made a stock investment that was informed by the P beyond simply seeing, is there a P?
Yeah.
Is it NA or a number? Because if it is a number, the business is profitable.
Yeah.
Or if there is no number, it is not profitable. But there's very little, I believe, you can deduce from a P, especially in a business where profits are growing quickly, because that P number is changing on a daily basis, on an hourly basis. Now, for older world businesses, I think some traditional stock analysts will stack the P of similar businesses beside each other and use it to take a view on which one might be relatively cheaper.
Yeah.
It's something I've never done. And we as a team, we have never discussed the P of a business. So it is definitely has a role. It has had a role. But other ratios, I think, in the investing world today are far more relevant, whether it's a multiple of sales or whether it's the price to earnings growth ratio. But the P ratio itself is something that I don't want to declare as useless, but has never been a great use to me. What about you, Rory?
I won't say it's useless, but it's a tool. It's part of a toolkit that you can use to get a very first glance look at something.
Okay.
Like, it's never something that you would use as an investment thesis.
It's like a cigarette lighter in your car. You'd be shocked if anyone ever uses it.
Yeah.
But it's good to have it there.
Well, I find like new investors do lean on it quite heavily, because it's something that if you read Investing 101, it's probably the first thing that's going to come up, and people are going to focus in on that because it's very solid and you can look at it across a number of companies.
That's right.
But it tells you so little.
Very, very little.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So that was PE ratio. So let's move on to the elevator pitch then. So for this week, I asked you to pick one mega trend that you're most excited about over the next 5 or 10 years. So we've, on this podcast, I think we've talked about a lot of different mega trends, from, you know, the alternative meat revolution to 5G we've mentioned before. But I want you to pick one that you think would be kind of very influential globally over the next 5 or 10 years. Emmett, I'll come to you first. I'll give you 60 seconds.
60. Oh, great. So for me, the most pressing megatrend, as opposed to my favorite megatrend, is the climate crisis.
Okay.
Polar ice is melting, with the net result of trillions of litres of fresh water being added to the oceans, which is changing the salinity of the seas. Those very seas have become plastic soup, with the Great Pacific Garbage Patch being estimated at 15 million square kilometres in size, which is about the size of Russia. And even last night, just last night, St. Mark's Square in Venice City was submerged by the highest tide seen in the city in 50 years. And now I think at the moment they're saying the highest tide. So we are looking at a global disaster. And I'm an absolute believer that it is the greatest challenge that humankind in our generation will have to face. So the climate crisis is the mega trend, I believe, that will most touch every living creature's life over the next 10 years. And as a result, it is the one that, while I wouldn't say most excited about, is the one that I believe every problem presents opportunities, and therefore it is the mega trend I am most engaged in. 101. 1 minute and 1 second.
Bang on. So that was the climate crisis. Rory?
Yeah, I'm going to go for a kind of broad one, I suppose. One mega trend that I really don't think is going to take off is VR.
Yeah.
I think it's totally overblown and it's kind of silly at this point. But one thing I do love is voice. So whether you're talking about kind of an echo in your home, or AirPods using Hey Siri, I really think voice is going to be a very important part. I've just set Siri off on your phone there. And on my computer. Stop listening. sorry, I won't say her name again. So I think that voice is going to play a very big part in the future. I think, you know, Google a while ago talked about ambient computing, having a computer kind of all around you all the time in some way, shape or form. And that might sound quite dystopian, but it has the ability to change really the way we live. You know, the Google, I think it was a year ago, demonstrated when they were talking to someone in different languages how they could instantly translate between people who were listening in through their Google Pods or whatever it was. So I think that's quite an interesting kind of future megatrend, and that's, I'm not sure exactly how to play it yet, but
yeah,
I like it.
Well, just for the fact you set off Siri there when you were talking about it, I think I have to go with voice. You kind of got it right in action there. So that's about it from this week's Stock Club. Don't forget about all the great new stuff in the My Wall Street app and My Wall Street desktop at the moment. If there's anything you want us to discuss or explain on the next episode of Stock Club, please make sure to get in touch. You can contact us on Twitter, that's at My Wall Street HQ, or email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. That's pod@mywallstreet.com. Please don't forget to subscribe to Stock Club. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a review for us on whatever podcasting platform you listen to us on. From all of us here today, we'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Happy investing.